Hello, this is Artie Shaw, your host for the next hour. The program is called Conversations with Artie Shaw, and that was my theme song you just heard, Summit Ridge Drive, so-called because it was originated at an address named Summit, at an address, Summit Ridge Drive in California. My guest for this coming hour is a man that could not make it for an ordinary evening show, as we say, live, because he is a critic and he has the onerous duty of going to movies and theater and covering these events for us. And moreover, he's not only just a critic, he falls into the especially hated critic role. And I don't think, deservedly so, but we'll go into that a little later. At any rate, just to give you a few of the basic vital statistics, he's the film critic since 1963, actually, for a magazine called The New Leader. That's a bi-weekly. And he's also the theater critic for a weekly magazine, New York Magazine, not to be confused with The New Yorker. And he also does theater for the Hudson Review, a rather illustrious quarterly that's been in existence as long as I can remember. And a man of rather high and, I would almost say, impeccable standards, which is, of course, why a lot of people might come to dislike what he says about them or their works. At any rate, here he is, John Simon, and we're going to be talking about theater and about film, but mostly we're going to be talking about criticism and what the critic is. John, it's nice to have you here finally.
Well, it's nice to be here.
We've only talked a couple of times about these things, once on a program and the other time on the way up here today. I wanted to ask you for comments on, for example, I made a couple of notes. The word critic, I'm a big word freak. And in Skeet's Etymological, they give derivations of the word, and finally you trace it back to the Greek, kritikos, able to discern. Compare kritos, a judge, or criterion is from the same source, which is, of course, a test or a standard. How do you feel about that as it applies to you?
Well, goodness, I mean, I think etymology is a marvelous thing, but I'm not certain that's relevant to what I'm trying to do.
But don't you think you are doing those things?
Well, yes.
You are trying to discern, you are judging,
yes.
And you are looking for, you have your own criteria, obviously.
Yes, yes, all of that
I think
is
it
true.
Covers.
Yes.
Sometimes I think language is wiser than the people that use it.
Oh, sure, no question about it. I always define the role of the critic as being threefold. He is first a teacher, he is second an artist, and he is third a philosopher.
Yeah,
that sort of
I think where
it.
You run into your problems, and as I see them, the problems you have with people taking great issue and angry at you, is when you try to impose those standards on people who insist on your treating their work as entertainment.
Yes, that's one of the problems. There are many problems.
That's one of the big ones, I think. There's huge difficulty in people understanding the difference between the word art and the word amusement.
Yeah.
I mean, both have roles.
Yes.
And, of course, art can also be amusing and entertaining.
Right.
If it is good art, it is.
Yeah.
But entertainment isn't always art.
Exactly.
And you generally come down pretty hard on it when it isn't.
Well, not entirely. You see, I'm always willing to give good entertainment its due. And I say
You think there's a place for it.
Yes, exactly. And I'll take a film like Bullet, for example, and I'll give it a perfectly favorable review.
Or The French Connection, right.
I'll say this is not a work of art.
I hadn't even seen what you wrote on it, but I'll bet you didn't dislike it.
I haven't written it yet, but it will be a favorable review, certainly. Yeah. Within its limitations.
Right. So you're taking it in terms of its intent, right?
Yeah. So, well, yes and no. I mean, intent is a tricky thing because if you're going to give top marks for something because it fulfills its intent, I mean, then you have to still, then you're a bad critic because then you're not considering that some intents are better than other intents and some intents are worth more than other intents.
No, but I meant in the broadest sense or maybe in the lower sense that if a man intends not to be pompous or pretentious, you will treat him
absolutely.
Kindness,
I will
say
this is a very good piece of entertainment. It isn't art, but it's marvelous fun. Go and see it.
The word pretentious is, I think, one of the words that would bug you, would it not?
Right, very much
not
so.
Not the word bugs you, but
no,
the
concept
to be pretentious.
Yeah. Of course.
All right, so then I think we've covered that pretty clearly as far as I'm concerned, but if you have any comments to make about
that
further.
No, that's all right. That isn't really the problem. The two or three other problems seem to be even more. Well, no, that is one of them.
I think it's a major
one.
I don't believe you can duck that.
People do not really distinguish between entertainment and art. And in fact, I mean, most of current film criticism is postulated on the notion that film is an entertainment.
Well, of course it has been. That's what the whole title of your book is about, movies into film.
Right.
You're treating film as a very serious medium in which the art criteria can be utilized.
Yeah, exactly.
And movies could never be guilty of that.
Right. Well, the point being is that in books we know exactly what we're about. We know that there are books by people like Herman Wouk and James Mitchell and whoever they're, and Jack
and
Suzanne and Irving
Wallace.
Et
cetera, Harold Robbins.
And some of them are a little better than others, none of them is art. I mean, those are entertainments. And those I tend to leave aside. They're okay for those who want them, but they're not what I'm concerned with. And
you're not really interested in them.
Right. And I'm trying to do the same thing in film. But in film, there has been so little art. And the people who have loved film have loved it so insanely and on such a highly personal and slightly, I would say, crazy criteria.
You're talking
of their
about
own.
Buffs.
Yeah, buffs, and also these auteur critics and cineasts and whatever names they all go by. These people have loved film in a kind of absolutely insane way, which meant you had to love every film. I mean, even the worst film you love.
Oh, you mean you're talking about now the Kay Francis cult, for example?
Well, that's one version of it. The other is the sort of the auteur cult where one director, however cheesy he may be,
Bud Bettiger.
Yeah, that's a typical example.
I mean, Cahiers
yes. Cahiers de Cinema.
They once made him the big guy.
Of course.
I knew Bud very well.
Yeah,
he must have had a great laugh.
Right. But I mean, even people like Howard Hawks, I mean, or John Ford, who are more serious directors, they're not artists.
They make good films.
They make very good commercial films. Right? Yeah, excellent craft, but not artists. And these idiots, these new critics, these auteur critics, have made people like Hawks and Ford into great artists. And that is something I combat with tooth and nail. They're not. Because if they're artists, then what are people like Bergman and Fellini and Antonioni and Truffaut and people like that?
Well, so in effect, then, what you're saying is that your standards, if you could be called guilty of anything, culpable of anything, it would be that your standards are higher than most people in the fields in which you operate
I suppose so. Yeah.
They don't think you have the right to that.
Right.
Which brings me, of course, to a most interesting point. And I keep saying this to people who attack not only you, but anyone else who happens to look unfavorably at what they do. And that's even a third. We're on several forks in the road here. Let's take one at a time. As for the aspect of people who do not like a critic when he doesn't like their work and who like a critic when he does like their work, I mean, there's the have your cake and eat it too, isn't it? Mm. I mean, I've known people, and I've known a lot of people. I've been privileged to know many people in the film business and the theatrical business, and sometimes not so privileged, underprivileged to know them. But in any case, I know the peculiar thing. They will say so-and-so is the worst no-good so-and-so in the whole world as a critic.
Yeah.
Until he gives them a favorable review.
Right.
And then he will be immediately quoted in their review.
Yes, of course.
So I've often said, well, if you're going to take him when he's good for you, then you cannot say what you're saying when he's bad for you.
Right.
Well, they don't like that one.
Yeah.
That's very childlike, isn't it?
Of course.
And of course, that's one of the basic problems in that whole business. Childishness.
Yeah, well, one of the troubles is that criticism has not been very tough in this country. Europe has a much tougher tradition of criticism.
The
standards.
More rigorous there.
Yeah, well, they're getting less rigorous there, too. They've gotten much less rigorous.
But certainly have been.
But they used to be, And here, they've always been on the whole. There have been a few people like Mencken or Nathan and so on who were fairly
James
tough.
Agee.
Agee wasn't that tough.
Agee kind of liked pictures.
Agee liked...
I
mean, there's something awful.
I knew Jim very well.
There's something awful about people who say, don't you like movies? You know, they read your reviews and you've attacked, say, 10 bad pictures in a row because there were 10 bad pictures. I said, don't you like movies? I said, I like movies much more than you do. I like them so much that I want them to be really the very best thing they can be.
That seems obvious to me. The people who hate people are generally those who have a deep love for what people ought to be.
Mm. The thing that they don't understand is that in politics... The producers, whoever they are, that in politics we have a two-party system, which means that what the Republicans like, the Democrats won't like, and vice versa.
Even if they really do.
And we think it's a good thing to have a two-party system. We think it would be very bad if there were only one party. We get justifiably upset when in Vietnam you have an election in which there's only one candidate running. Well, so, and the same thing should be understandable in the arts, too. I mean, if Merrick or whoever it is,
Or Prince, or whoever it is,
produces a show, or a filmmaker, or a film company, United Artists, puts out a film, and I knock it, I'm just being a Democrat to their Republican, or a Republican to their Democrat. But well, they can't understand that.
I don't think that that in itself is the subject for a really lengthy discussion.
No,
I think you and I could dispose of that in 2 minutes.
But, for example, United Artists will not admit me to their screenings. That is to say, they will not invite me. They say they won't lock me up. And this is all over one bad review I gave.
John, I'm going to have to cut in. First, to remind our audience that this is Artie Shaw. The program is called Conversations with Artie Shaw. The man with whom I'm having my conversation is the, well, I'll have to say it, highly controversial film and theater critic, John Simon. He has been attacked by almost everybody who he's ever had an unkind word to say. About whom he's had an unkind word to say, and he's had lots of people about whom he's had unkind words to say. At any rate, we'll be right back and continue this.
A few years ago, when America was still a Puritan country, the idea of selling a feminine hygiene deodorant on television was inconceivable. Today, thousands of women who don't read consumer reports are buying and using feminine sprays that are probably useless and might, in fact, do them harm. If you read consumer reports, you'd know that some women who've used them have developed conditions from mild rashes to grapefruit-sized swellings that have shocked their doctors. But that's just one of the health-saving things you may not know if you haven't been reading consumer reports. A year's subscription, including a bonus copy of the 1972 448-page buying guide issue, selling on the newsstand for $2.65, and the 1973 buying guide, when published, cost just $8. That's $3.90 less than you'd pay at the newsstand for these issues and buying guides. Send no money. They'll bill you later. Just call YU65800 or mail your name and address to Consumer Reports, care of WRVR, New York 10027, or phone right now YU65800.
Okay, we're back.
May I say something? Go ahead.
Well, we're just coming back, and I want to identify who we are for anybody who just happened to tune in. This is Artie Shaw, your host for the next three quarters of an hour, approximately. My guest is John Simon, the noted and, as I said just before the break, highly controversial and, I could even say, highly disliked by a number of people, film and theater critic. And we've been talking about the function of the critic, what he is in our society, and let alone how he gets that way or what his standards are. But first of all, we're, I think, on the subject of the function.
A former girlfriend of mine once put it rather well, I must say. She said the difference between someone like Bob Bluestein and you is, and Bluestein and I are good friends, by the way, is that when Bob attacks something, he tends to do it more in sorrow than in anger. This was when he was writing drama criticism for the New Republic. And he hates it and he puts it down, but he does it in a kind of pitying way to some extent. He says, worse, when you kill something, I mean, you really enjoy your work, and you kill it in such a way that you don't want it to raise its ugly head ever again, if you can help it.
And this I think that's definitely true.
And this is true, because I think pseudo-art, bad art, phony art, pretentious. Now, I would never do this to an innocent little unpretentious play
or
film.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
But something, you know, that pretends to be a great masterpiece, you know, a film like this god-awful Visconti adaptation of Death in Venice, for example.
Oh, well, that should never have
been now, that sort of thing has to be hit with every piece of ammunition you have, because it is phony and disgusting and pretentious and misguided.
Start with the fact that you had an absolutely classic gem of writing, and that a man has taken that gem and bowdlerized it into a rather cheap and vulgarized version. I couldn't more agree with you, but that's not the point.
All right, or similarly, when you have something like, say, Jesus Christ Superstar, or when you have something like...
And by the way, that was not a bad record at all.
No, but the show,
the
show is a horror, you see.
Now we're trying to take something out of the medium into which it was for which it was originated, and stretch it out into something else, and make it again into a circus.
Right, or whatever it is, or something like No, 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 Net, an idiot revival, you know, that sort of is brought in as a kind of salvation of the American theater.
Well, it's a freak show, isn't it? Really, it's really
this
a freak
sort of thing.
Show.
Yeah.
What it says is, look, it's 63 years old and it can jump up and down and move its legs and arms. Now, as I think you said, and you and I have talked about this somewhere else, but as you said, she wasn't good when she was supposed to be good.
Right.
So why should she suddenly be idealized or idolized because she got to be 63?
Yeah.
It's perfectly well to see she got to be 63. Why didn't she go somewhere and bake bread and have children or join the Woman's Lib movement, whatever it is?
Yeah.
But don't bore me on the theater stage.
Right.
And also, of course, having seen the show, I cannot understand. Now, Aaron, playing your role, I cannot understand what audiences go there for. It is one of
the pretty weird audiences.
Well, you know, I suppose what happens is that when something gets to be a hot ticket, you have a status by having gone
to exactly, absolutely.
There's nothing to do with entertainment, art, theater, or anything else anymore.
And you even manage to convince yourself that you're enjoying it, though in fact you're not.
It's hard for me to do.
Well, you don't, but a lot of people do.
Well, I wonder. Yes, I suppose they say, well, it's well done. Yeah. As if that's got anything to do with it. We expect it to be well done at the prices they charge.
Right.
If it weren't well
it's
done,
not,
it
it's
would
not
be,
even that well done.
Well, I mean to say it's put together with some skill and some craft. The lights go on and the people move and the curtain comes up and down and the you know the machinery on the set works. All of that. Like the Rothschilds works.
Yes.
I mean, people admire the machinery, you know, and that stage is good machinery. I mean, the thing, I got to be a cuckoo clock there in the back for a while every time that thing would open and we'd see him in the back. But the fact is it does work.
Yes,
and one has to admire the precision with which all these this clockwork comes together,
yeah.
I suppose. But that's hardly worth the evening in the theater. I'd rather buy myself a see-through clock, wouldn't you? Well, back to what we were talking about. So a lot of people seem to think, and I wanted to have this opportunity to ask you these questions, because I think I will more or less... If I were to speak for you, I think I'd say many of the things you would be saying, except in my own language as opposed to yours, which is sometimes a little classier.
But if you don't watch out, you will end up speaking for me. Go ahead.
Well, I won't, no. I wanted to ask you this question. A lot of people seem to think we would be far, quote, better off, end quote, if there were no critics, so that the audience could then judge for themselves. Well, of course, in an over-communicated world like ours, that's a very difficult problem.
Yeah, exactly.
So how would you define your function? I mean, people say, are critics necessary? What would your answer to that be?
I'll say, if there were only one kind of critic in the world, that would be a very dangerous thing. But the world is so constituted that there are all kinds. There are very lowly reviewers who merely report what they saw at the theater or at the movies and what the audience reaction was. And there's a kind of public for that kind of reviewing. They sort of get this account by some rather pedestrian little newspaper man who tells them what he saw at the theater.
A journalist, a reviewer, who said the audience enjoyed it. Et
and so they read that and they say, oh, well, if everybody else enjoyed it, I'll enjoy it too.
That's Judith Crist, really.
Well, yes, she's.
She
thinks she's more than that, but essentially that is what she is.
Oh, I've never seen her be more than that.
She thinks she is. Well, anyway, so her bearing is certainly always over that.
The fact that she wants to be an aristocrat or an autocrat.
Anyway, so then there is that kind of thing. Then there are the kind of people like Harold Clerman, for example, who, or Arthur Schlesinger, or several others, who are sort of intelligent men.
Oh, Harold's a bright guy, I think.
Yeah, and who sort of write about the theater or movies or whatever it is from an intelligent point of view.
He gets down to some guts, at least.
Yeah, but I don't think that they really have what I would consider a first-class critical mind, and they don't really get to the bottom of the thing. I could name others, you know, Walter
Kerr. Well, we're not dealing with personalities.
Right.
We're dealing with
an
issue.
They're all right as far, but they're not really critics in the sense that Bob Bluestein was a critic, in the sense that even Richard Gilman, whom I don't particularly like and whom I always disagree with, is a critic, in the sense that Eric Bentley is a critic. I mean, this is the major league.
I mean, people have done their homework.
Well,
like Edmund Wilson in literature.
Yeah, well, of course, Edmund Wilson, certainly. Lionel Trilling, if you want, in literature.
Right,
we have
lots of
them. Alfred Kazin, we have lots of them in literature.
Yeah. Well, there's a standard there. There's been a standard historically.
Right. And one could name a lot of others, Elizabeth Hardwick and so on. Trouble is that a lot of people, you know, sort of read, let's say, a magazine for other things where it is on a different level. And suddenly, for example, New York Magazine, I think, tends to be on a somewhat more popular level than my criticism really is. Now, I think my phrasing in New York Magazine is, by and large, readable and pleasant, although there's occasionally a big word that stops them and bothers them. But on the whole, it's a kind of fairly, I think, light style in the Hudson Review or in the New Leader.
You write your style, you sort of try to temper it.
I try to temper
it
a little bit, yeah.
Right.
Not my vocabulary, but my
sort of... You can't really change that.
The vocabulary can't change, but you can change sort of the sentence structure to some extent, and you can change the frame of reference. I mean, I use by and large, a slightly more modest margin of deference in a magazine like New York, and so on. Nevertheless, my standards are highbrow and are intellectual, and so they come from page 53, where they read Judith Crist raving about some commercial film, to page 54, where I am very down on something like Promises, Promises, or
Applause.
Or Applause.
I don't know, but I'm saying.
Yeah, well, I wasn't particularly down on it. I wasn't particularly up on it, but I was particularly down on it, whatever it is. And then they can't, you know, they get disoriented, and this bothers them. But the point is that I think a critic serves a certain audience, that audience which is roughly on his intellectual level.
Well, what does one do? I mean, don't we still have to come back to the same simple and really, as I said, primal criterion that if you aren't functioning as a critic to the satisfaction of the readership, you aren't going to be there very long.
Right. Well,
isn't
exactly.
Isn't that that simple,
exactly.
Finally?
Exactly, and some of them...
You won't find a market any more than if you write a highbrow story that no one wants to publish, you're not going to get published.
Well, you know, you can sometimes, what happens is in fiction, you can sort of publish something on your own as a vanity thing,
yeah,
and then
but that,
200 years later, somebody discovers that you're
really... Well, or like Bach wrote his music, and 50 years later, Mendelssohn discovered it. But that's not what we're discussing here.
We're
talking about a weekly or bi-weekly or a monthly endeavor called criticism, or even a daily one if you work
certainly,
for a paper.
Certainly.
So if you work for the Times, they might rail against you and hate you, but they're really not hating you. They're hating an editorial policy.
Yeah.
Because that editorial policy is directly behind you. Those are your troops.
Yes.
Isn't that so?
I suppose so.
Well, I mean, in other words, put it as simply as this. The critic has a function because the function is paid for by people who sell his work.
Yes, it's true. In the long run, it's true. But you can look at it from the other direction, too, that a critic writes to satisfy his own needs and his own standards and his own beliefs and his own integrity as a critic.
Well, that's after he's been hired.
Yes, of course.
But if we start with the fact that...
But, you know, remember that I've been fired as much as I've been hired. You know, I used to do, for example, television reviews for Channel 13, which is supposed to be a fairly highbrow educational operation, and they let me go because they were cowardly little... so-and-so's.
You mean they were cowed into it?
Yeah, they got a lot of protests from idiots like columnists or whoever would call them up and complain that I was unkind to Marlene Dietrich or whatever, and this bothered them.
John, can I ask a question that I hope you'll understand? It's a personal one, but it's really rather impersonal in the context. Why are you quite so angry as you are? Don't you think that just as much could be accomplished if you were, let's say, not objective, I know you bridle at that word, and I don't want to use the word object, but if you did it a little more dispassionately, let us say?
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, certain things do arouse my passions, and when my passions are aroused, I think passions are a legitimate part of a human being.
Well, they're certainly a legitimate part of art, no question about that.
Right, and I think criticism is an art, you know. If criticism were a science, one would try to be very dispassionate about it.
I see,
but as long as criticism is an art, I can have as much passion as Michelangelo or Raphael
or Beethoven or anybody. I have to accept the logic and rationality of what you're saying, that if what you are saying is when I sit down to write something, I worry about my prose, in some cases more than the writer of the film or play that I'm reviewing.
Yeah.
Therefore, I think I'm entitled to the same respect for my passionate views as he is.
Right.
Well, in that case, I don't see how anybody in his right mind can take issue with the fact that you can get angry.
One of my criteria is that for a piece of criticism is that it should be a work of art, and a work of art is always passionate.
Yeah, well, it's a good question, of course,
except,
and that is what is minor and major art and all that. We get into all of that, but that's very esoteric.
That's beside the point. Minor art can be just as passionate as major.
Of course. Anyway, the point is that whether criticism is an art form or not, there's certainly nothing wrong with a man attempting to make it so.
Right, exactly.
And I would, I'd have to.
Well, I think it has
there's
been.
There's a book, John Livingston Lowe's book, The Road to Zapatoo.
Yes, that's
my
a great
God,
work.
What a classic work,
it's
and it's a
work.
Criticism.
Right, exactly.
And I remember reading that when I was a young man taking courses in literature, and I ran into that thing as sort of a landmark of its kind. But it's like a detective story into the mentality of a dead man named Coleridge through two works.
Certainly.
You know the book,
yeah,
I'm
right,
sure.
Of course.
Well, if what you're saying then, if that's the kind of standard, the kind of criterion you hold up to.
Yeah, well, one doesn't always make it. In fact, in weekly journalism, one almost never makes it. But that's what one is striving for.
No, I'm not discussing whether one makes it, because I think all one can do with an ideal is try to approximate it.
Exactly.
You hold up a standard for yourself and say, under that standard, I'm not happy.
Right.
If on an occasion I approach that standard, I feel better. And if now and then I do hit the standard, I feel marked.
Fine.
Isn't that really?
Sure.
All right, so in that respect, I don't see how anyone in his right mind, as I said, can argue with the intent of a man trying to approach his work on an artistic level.
Well, you see, the thing is that all rationality goes out of the window when people are violently disagreed with. And this doesn't mean just people...
Wouldn't you think, though, that they would understand that that's very good for their business? There used to be a phrase. I remember, you see, something very wrong is going on. I mean, our society is homogenizing itself very badly, and that people want this bland, custard-like thing where everybody sits and nods like automata.
Yeah.
It's a pity, because years ago, I remember that the phrase used to be, controversy is the essence of show business.
I know.
Whatever happened to that?
The society has changed.
And how can you have controversy if a man like you doesn't say, I hate...
America used to be a much tougher society than it's gotten to be.
But you see, it isn't. We are... I tell you, of course, the problem is, you know, the people who work in theater, that is the successful ones, are willy-nilly. They become establishment-minded.
No.
They don't think they are. They think they're attacking the establishment. But how can, for example, a Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, this is ludicrous, finance a film like, say, The Strawberry Statement, and expect anything to come out of that? You know, childish.
Yeah.
The Strawberry Statement is the angry and maybe sometimes inchoate argument of a bunch of kids against a system they don't even comprehend fully.
Yeah.
They only know it's got to go.
Yeah.
Well, then you can't have a company, a corporate entity like a Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, which is in the real estate business, in the music publishing, in the copyright, in the legal business, in the acquisition. How can they make a film and even come close to understanding?
Exactly.
They wouldn't even buy it if they got it right.
This is WRVR New York, broadcasting with maximum power from its new transmitter atop the Empire State Building.
Absolutely.
They hire a screenwriter that they think is a young man, therefore he can do. This is another idiot lumping together of young, youth.
Yes. Well,
what is that? Youth is no more of a monolith than age.
Exactly.
Well, so in effect, what you're doing then is you're playing gadfly in a very large sense.
Yes. I mean, not deliberately, but it comes
out
that way.
I don't mean deliberately, no. But I mean, if your role is that you don't like something, you have to play gadfly.
Yes, right.
And you play it with the most vicious sting you can bring to bear.
Exactly. Because if I believe that something is totally rotten and misguided and pretentious and foolish and arrogant and that it really, that I believe it to be poisonous in the sense that it ruins something that could be very good, for example, Death in Venice, for example, whatever, it could be something else, then it has to be exposed, it has to be shown how utterly corrupt and stupid and vicious and arrogant and mindless and somehow deleterious this world.
Well, what you're really, I think, saying is that you're for anything that is life-enhancing, and you are against anything that is life-diminishing.
Right. Now, I may be wrong about what I consider to be enhancing and what I consider to be diminishing, but I have very strong notions about it, and I must stand by them.
Again, one can't argue about the detail of whether you're right or wrong about a given particular subject. I mean, I might see a film that I think is marvelous. I can say this, and I say this to you in all candor. I saw a film called The Graduate. I read your review of The Graduate. You showed me things about that film in your review that at my first viewing of it, thoughtlessly dismissing it when I went away, that I had not seen. Which, I must say, not too many people I read are able to do. So, I mean, I have to thank you there.
Yes.
If I were involved with the film as distributor or as producer or as director or as actor, I might feel very stung at what you said, but I would have to, if I were an honest man, recognize the truth.
Yeah.
A lot of this was stereotyping, that all the old people were no good. All the only two young people we saw were models, paragons of virtue and nobility.
Right.
Well, I mean, that is an oversimplification. I'm sorry, it is a very bad
one. For example, we have a film now, The Last Picture
John,
Show.
John, can I interrupt? We have to take a break for station identification. I want to remember where we were. We were talking about The Graduate, and you started to say, for example.
Yeah.
Let's hold it there. All right, this is WRVR, this is Artie Shaw. I'm talking to my guest, John Simon, a noted and controversial critic of theater and film, and I guess anything else that he reads or looks at. And we'll be back right after our station break.
When the conversation turns to new developments in the arts, sciences, or literature, can you speak with knowledge and authority? Now there's a monthly magazine that can keep you abreast of the dramatic changes and new ideas that truly aware people are talking about. The magazine is Intellectual Digest. It gives you a goldmine of fascinating, informative articles, selected from more than 300 sophisticated publications covering every area of human thought. Provocative insights that you can use to enliven any conversation, in any company. Right now, you can get a complimentary issue of the current Intellectual Digest, along with a no-obligation trial subscription to the next 11 issues, for only $5. That's half the regular subscription price. And if you're not completely satisfied, you can cancel your subscription within 14 days. Just tear up your bill. For your complimentary issue of Intellectual Digest and the trial subscription, write Digest, WRVR, New York 10027. That's Digest, WRVR, New York 10027.
Okay, we're back. This is Artie Shaw. The program is Conversations with Artie Shaw. The man with whom I'm having my conversation is John Simon, critic, extraordinary critic, sometimes hostile, sometimes, I think, very fair. On the whole, certainly a critic in depth. We were talking about The Graduate and the fact that your criticism showed me things in it that I had really not questioned. I usually pride myself on questioning it, and that reminded you of a for example.
Yeah, take a living example, because The Graduate is past history now. The Last Picture Show by Peter Bogdanovich, which is a film that is now a tremendous success. On the strength of it, Peter Bogdanovich is getting the most incredible assignments in Hollywood.
Hollywood, of course, is the hottest property around.
Of course, Hollywood is desperate. I mean, that's one of the reasons why critics are in greater trouble than ever with the industry, because the industry does feel that it's bleeding. And they're right, they are bleeding through their own stupidity.
Happily so. It may, if it survives, come out a better
industry. Of course. But the point is that the theater is not in good shape either, and when people are desperate, they become even more stupid and narrow-minded.
They start playing safe, which is the most unsafe thing you can do.
Right, and also they cannot stand any kind of criticism anymore. That's the first thing that happens to them under those circumstances.
Again, back to that thing of they don't understand the controversy.
The man from United Artists said to one of my editors, he says, "Why should we press a knife into the hands of our assassins when we are bleeding?" The point is they're bleeding through their own stupidity, and critics
also
are not assassins.
Critics are
only pitifully delighted when, after seeing hours worth of junk, they can finally see one good thing. They will go out of their way to write the most enthusiastic.
Well, again, you're back to what you said earlier. They don't want a critic. They want a publicity man. They want a press agent. They want to help a man to help themselves.
Right. But now, take this is the difference between a reviewer and a critic, which is a thing that has been debated into the ground boringly by everybody. The real difference is this. Take a thing like The Last Picture Show. It's the biggest hit. It's making Peter Bogdanovich, who is 31 or whatever years old, into a great
He's this week's genius.
Right. But what is The Last Picture Show? It is a perfectly well-constructed movie superficially. It has an authentic look to it, or an authentic seeming look to it, and it works, and it tells a story of some dull little people in a Texas one-horse town who, however, are human beings and have some right to our looking at them and thinking about them. But what happens? It is a film that was made by this young man who has been a slavish worshiper of the so-called great auteurs, the so-called great Hollywood filmmakers, and who has spent years and years of his life sitting in cinematheques or wherever and studying the films of people like Hawks, like Ford, like Alan Dwan,
Hitchcock,
and right. and also a lot of lesser giants. Men, yeah, and George Stevens and whoever. And he has memorized them the way a schoolboy, if he has a photographic memory, can memorize thousands and thousands of lines of poetry.
He's memorized techniques.
Yeah,
and
everything.
Scenes.
Yeah, it's right. Shots, you know, camera right. angles, right. everything. And now he's gone out, and he was a kind of bad critic, a so-called critic, who was writing about these directors when he was younger. And so now he's written books, sort of fan books about them, which some people think are critical books. And so now he goes out and he makes this film exactly the way Stevens and Hawks and Hitchcock and Ford would have made it.
You mean that he's developed a repertoire?
Yeah, it's totally derivative.
A bag, as
completely derivative. I mean, it's eclectic in that it is not just derived from one director,
it's
derived from a dozen.
Well, it's a bag made up of bits and odds and ends of lots and lots of people's techniques.
So there's nothing original about that film. I mean, people are, for example, hailing it that it's in black and white. How marvelously daring that in 1971 a film should be in black and white. Well, so what? I mean, he simply did that because the filmmakers he admires in those days worked mostly in black and white, and it's a kind of tribute to them, and it certainly makes that Texan place look a little crummier.
It's pretty remarkable that he got it off the ground, I must say, as a deal today's market.
Yes, well, it so happens that there's some young producers behind him who are swingers and movers.
Who raise the money.
Yeah, who raise the money. All right, fine, why not? But again, this is not a great achievement to film it in black and white instead of in color. It's just a kind of fairly appropriate thing that anyone would have thought of doing had he set out to do a film in the manner of Howard Hawks or Hitchcock or whoever in the 50s or 40s when these people were making their films in black and white for the most part. So then what? Then the story doesn't hold together because it's a long book by Larry McMurtry, or a longish book, which Bogdanovich and McMurtry first shot as a four-hour film, then they cut it down to 3.5 hours, and finally they cut it down to 2 hours, and a whole lot of essential information
had to be left out.
Right. So and it does not hang together. If you look at it closely, there are about 20 major loopholes in that film.
Yeah, well, you don't understand why people are doing what
they're doing. Right, exactly.
And simple.
Whole things are not explained. I mean, whole things sort of come in out of left field and float in midair and disappear. Also, it is very much softened down. The book is much tougher than the film. The film is a cop-out in many small but important ways.
All right, so you were saying...
So what you have is really quite a mediocre film. But what you also have is you have a mediocre film surrounded by a lot of really trashy films, because it so happens that at this moment in time, trash is all over the place.
I mean, around a bunch of molehills, a little tiny mound.
Right. And so now Bogdanovich is the hottest property. Everybody wants him. They want him to write criticism for Esquire, to make Barbara Streisand's next film. And what
John,
is it? He's a mediocre little man, and they're carrying on about him. As if
you're one of the
not.
Great tragedies in this business, you see. I mean, you have a Dennis Hopper, and he comes through with Easy Rider. And all of a sudden, I mean, the world isn't large enough to contain him until his next movie, and then they won't even release it. So, I mean, this is that thing called instant success, instant glory.
It's the worst thing.
No one is prepared for it. You see, no dues are paid. Yeah. I'll give you this about the Fords and the Stevens and those guys, whether one says they're artists or not. They were at least honest journeymen.
Yes, they learned
their craft.
Surely.
I mean, a guy like Hitchcock. You know, it's known that guy shot maybe 10 feet of extra film. He cut as he went. You could not argue with his skills. They were absolutely impeccable.
Yeah.
Well, so you get a kid who comes along and he gets lucky and he shoots 360 degrees around any scene and then takes it into an editing room, a massive spaghetti, and hands it to some capable editor and maybe comes up with something. And then that week, as we say, he becomes the genius, and suddenly they give him the power to hang himself and kill himself. This is really what you're arguing about.
Yeah.
But now, so the critic, you mean you as the critic who point this obvious fact out, you're saying, look, the emperor doesn't have any clothes on.
Not only that, I'm trying to look at it in the perspective of a larger period of time, not just this tiny little moment that we're in at this second.
Well, unfortunately, that's like dealing with book publishing, where they're not interested in a book being sold 100 years from now. They want to get their money out on the cost accounting of 1970.
Well, that's fine. From their point of view, they're right. I mean, if they're businessmen, let them reckon in terms of dollars and cents.
Yeah,
but I'm
so
not a businessman. I'm a critic, and I'm reckoning in terms of what will the last picture show look like 10 years from now or 15 years from now. It'll be a mediocre film,
which is what it is.
I try to. I mean, this is perhaps arrogant, but I think this is what every critic has to do. I try to see the film from the point of view of the future, not just of the present. And that's
the
difference.
Or in the past as well, of course.
Of the past, of course, yeah.
Well, you're looking at it in a context of filmmaking, in perspective. Well, you're insisting on one simple thing, and I think this, if there's one thread through this entire discussion we've been having, you are insisting on a very high level of quality, and that is where you begin, and if something falls short of that, they can say to you, well, you're wrong to approach us with those standards, but you're saying, well, look, don't ask me to then.
Yeah.
Aren't you, in effect?
Yes.
Unless this is a nice little entertainment, don't ask me to take it too seriously. You'll go and say, all right, I had fun. It's fun. Don't think of it as great art.
Right.
You're not going to criticize a cartoon because it isn't a work by Michelangelo.
Right.
As long as it doesn't claim to be.
Exactly.
And I think that's it, isn't it?
Surely.
All right. So I think we've covered that. I think if not, the only thing I'm trying to do here, this isn't called the League to Exonerate John Simon that we're doing here, but I am trying to say that I think I fully concur in that aim. The question really is, do you feel, really, that this is a function that is good? I think it is, myself. Do you?
Yes, I mean, that. I think it's good for those people.
Good in the sense that it educates people.
Yes, for those people who want to be educated, or for those people who are already educated and who want a spokesman for
them. Well, there's also a very nice thing that can be said about criticism. Anytime a guy doesn't agree with what you're writing, he can always close the book or the page.
Right, certainly.
All right, let's get down to another word that is used a lot. I had a woman on the air with me the other evening named Eleanor Perry, whom you know.
Yeah.
And Eleanor, and neither Eleanor nor Frank, well, Frank was certainly not my favorite man, but that's not the point at all. I mean, I felt that he had a certain arrogance about what he did, in the sense that he knew how to make films. He made some pretty good films, one or two that were okay, but he used to talk a lot about the auteur. Now, he's married to a woman who wrote the screenplays, and she was also an auteur in that sense, because an auteur really translates to author.
Yes.
Now, again, going back to my Skeets etymological, I made these notes because I thought we'd talk about it. Auteur comes from the word Latin, auctorum, a part of auctor, an originator.
Yes.
Literally, and this is interesting, literally, quote, one who makes things to grow. Makes a thing to grow.
Yes, from augere.
Yeah, that's a fascinating one, isn't it? I've never quite seen that definition. But when you apply it to auteur, it's very good, because better than originator. Because a director can make something grow out of something that was originated by someone else and make it into something better. He can enhance a rather little story and make it into a big and important film, can he not?
Yeah.
I don't think he can take a bad story or a story that isn't well thought through and make it into anything really very good, but he can make it into better. So he's making something grow.
Yes.
He didn't say grow to the highest.
Yes. No.
So do you agree then with the term auteur?
Well, goodness, that's a long...
I mean, as I use it just here.
Yes.
All right. Well, the reason for the question is that, you see, we discussed, for example, such things as this cliché that makes the rounds. And the minute I hear a cliché like this, I back off and say, wait a minute. You know, film is a director's medium. Well, which film, which director, right?
Yeah.
It isn't always.
Yeah.
What would a film... If a director is a man who writes... and also is in charge of his production, you could say
I can give you some obvious examples. I mean, one of the greatest films of all time, into my mind, is The Children of Paradise. And
that is Cocteau.
Absolutely a writer's film. No, not Cocteau. I mean, it's Jacques Prévert's scenario.
But Cocteau's story?
No.
Les Enfants de Paradis?
Cocteau had nothing to do with it whatsoever. Jacques Prévert wrote the screenplay, and Marcel Carnet made the film.
But wasn't this based on the...
No, I know what you were thinking of. You were thinking
Les Enfants de Paradis?
Les Enfants Terribles. That's Cocteau.
It's
a different thing,
right.
A different ballgame altogether. No, Les Enfants, The Children of Paradise, is a film written by a brilliant French poet, Jacques Prévert, who was also a great scenarist and who did some marvelous scenarios.
How long ago was this made?
Oh, this was made in about 44, I would say 1944. It was during the end of the last period of World War II.
Shot in France?
In France, yeah. It was extraordinary that they could do it under the occupation. It's a great film, and it is a great film because a great writer wrote it, and a very pedestrian second-rate director, Marcel Carnet, who was good at sort of taking a well-written script and putting it very literally, very unimaginatively, but solidly on the screen.
So in other words, he had the craft to take this screenplay and simply render it into
film terms. That doesn't make him an auteur, sense.
So here's the perfect case in point where it was not a director's, writer's medium in that instance.
And, exactly.
I want to pursue this one, because this is really basic for me, and we're coming to the last section of our program, so I'm going to have to take a brief break. We'll be right back.
It's hard to sometimes understand what a radical and a revolutionary are. The terms are so misused. I would accept either if it means a radical alteration of society.
The difference in the news is how you see it.
And I wish that some official would reach that conclusion, that it was his duty to disclose lies, deceptions, and criminal acts to the American people.
The difference in RVR Morning is that Adam Powell tells it like he sees it. Weekday mornings from 7 to 10.
Well, we're back, and for those of you who may have joined us recently, I'll identify who we are. I'm Artie Shaw. This is a program that appears on WRVR every Tuesday night from 9 to 10 p.m., and here we are doing it. It's called Conversations with Artie Shaw, and the man with whom I'm having my conversation, and for me a very fascinating one, I hope so for you too out there, since we can't invite you to call in due to the fact that... he's unable to come here at the hours when we could do that. I had to tape the show. The man is John Simon. He's a critic. He's a film and theater critic. And as I said, he can't get here because his time isn't always his own. We've tried 3 or 4 weeks to get him here on a Tuesday, and in each case, an opening has prevented his being here. So I finally decided to get him in when he could do it, and we're taping the show. At any rate, we were discussing the question of the auteur, the author.
Yes.
What makes a film work? And where we were, for those of you, again, who didn't hear the earlier part of this, was that the cliché is that film is a director's medium, and John was just giving as an example a film in which not the director at all, but the writer was the man who made the film work.
My esteemed rival, Pauline Kael, has a book out now, which takes up the question of Citizen Kane, who is the auteur.
Oh, I've read that piece. It was in the New Yorker.
I mean,
three or four articles.
It's different. Sometimes it is the director who made the film. Sometimes it is the writer. But Anyway,
well, I'd certainly have hated to see Citizen Kane made with exactly the same people except for Greg Toland.
Yeah.
It would not have been
right,
the same
absolutely.
Film.
Absolutely. I think the cameraman can also be...
Oh, he can kill you. What everybody forgets is that a movie or a film or whatever you want to call it is pictures moving on an oblong of space. And if you don't have those pictures working for you, who cares what it says? It's a dull film.
Yes, it depends. If you're a very great artist like Ingmar Bergman, for example, I mean, he has done wonderful films with different cameramen. But wait, they've all been good cameramen.
They're all good ones, and if they're not good, he sees to it
that's
that they
right.
do what he
that's
wants.
That's right.
So one way or the other,
but I'm sure there have been films that have been saved by the cameraman. There's a film called The Honeymoon Killers, which the idiot critic of the Times, Roger Greenspan, hailed as the work of a new auteur director. The director had a snit.
Who was the director?
A man called Leonard Castle, who was a composer. He's not a director at all. He wrote it and he directed it. He had a snit. He quit. He didn't even finish doing it. It's the photographer and people like that who had to finish the film.
I think everybody knows it. If anyone thinks at all about film, a guy like Jimmy Wong Hao, my God, you put him in any picture, you are going to get moments of sheer dazzling cinematography, no matter what else you might have.
Right.
And that can help you. I mean, especially if you have a rather weak and unstructured piece of work.
Exactly.
You know? Well,
so it's a different case. But anyway, the auteurists have sort of decided there are some directors whom they worship, and they arrive at this rather irrationally by sort of criteria which make no sense to me whatsoever. But anyway, for example, a man like Alfred Werker, I mean, a real non-entity director of whom 99 people out of 100 haven't, or more, 9,999 haven't heard. But Alfred Werker is an auteur. Or Bud Bettis.
Is he a German director?
No, he's a Hollywood director.
Alfred Werker? What has he done?
I Walk by Night, or He Walks by Night.
Well, Bud Bettiger, of course. Bud Bettiger was a skilled craftsman. Westerns. He made westerns.
No, there are others.
Journeyman-like westerns.
I mean, you know,
I really thought it was remarkable. I thought it was a put-on when they used him as the...
Douglas Sirk was a real hack director, if ever there's been one. An okay hack director, but a hack. This has been made into a great man, an auteur.
Let me ask you about a film. I'm curious. We're coming close to the end. I just want to get to a couple of particulars. I saw a film years ago in Hollywood. This was in the so-called golden era when pictures were being made, you know, and they turn out anything. Golden, I mean, in the sense that it produced lots of gold, I guess is what they really mean. A film called Night Must Fall. Do you remember it?
Yes.
This is the Robert
Montgomery,
right? Rosalind Russell.
Yeah.
Well, there were a few very chilling moments in the film, and given what it set out to be, a chiller or a suspense film, it touched on some very serious things in people, and I thought rather well made. But interestingly enough, done by a man who up to that time and since has never been heard from. I can't think of his name. But he's a director that if I told you it was, you'd say, did he make that?
Well, I couldn't tell you who made that.
There you are. But he was a guy who was under contract. He did films. And I dare say somebody listening in this who knows anything about this, listening to this program, would know his name. But I could find it. And when we leave here, just for the hell of it, we'll look it up. I'm curious. But you'd see that he's never really done anything distinguished in his life. And yet here was a film that I ran deliberately 14 times in a row.
Yeah. Well,
I tried to find something wrong in the way that was put together.
Yeah.
And by God, there wasn't a slip.
Things can happen.
So it did, but you know, there was no auteur involved there, except it was a happy accident. All the elements fell in place. If there was an auteur there, I'll tell you who it was Montgomery.
Uh-huh.
Montgomery himself had very good script sense for what he was able to do.
Yes.
I think he could have been an important director if he'd taken that work more seriously. He tried, but it didn't work. He did some bad things. He did Ride the Pink Horse.
Yeah.
He didn't pick his properties as well as a director.
The Lady in the Lake, I think.
The Chandler story.
Yeah.
Well,
which wasn't too
unfortunate.
Bad.
But he had great sense, and he had a certain sensibility. Unfortunately, I think the actor thing got in his way.
Right.
The histrionic thing isn't necessarily the directorial thing. It's a different ability.
Yeah. But now imagine making an auteur out of a man like Sam Fuller. First of all, does that mean anything to you, Sam Fuller?
No, I never heard of his name.
Man has made the most god-awful films in the world. And for some crazy reason, usually this starts in Paris, with a bunch of French nuts who don't speak English, who don't understand about Hollywood.
Well, this is the Ruby Keeler cult, right?
Yeah, right. And they suddenly decide that Sam Fuller is a great director. Shock Corridor.
Let me ask you something. Do you think that's just a cultural cultural, a linguistic, a transcultural
misunderstanding? It is. I mean, it's the same way, for example, that, I mean, there are literary equivalents for this. The French, the greatest, some of the greatest French poets and critics who were really first-rate men of letters have thought that Edgar Allan Poe was a great poet.
Well, I mean,
he's not.
The Europeans discovered him just as they discovered who else? Oh, well, Robert Frost was.
I mean, you know, without people like Baudelaire and Mallarmé, to name
only. Baudelaire thought that Poe was great.
Yeah, they thought Poe was an absolutely first. They not any American or
why
English.
Why is it? You mean because that the somehow translation it,
yeah, that's right.
They,
yeah, because a foreign language always, a foreign language imperfectly known, revered because of its foreignness, because it's the grass in the other man's yard, which is always greener,
yeah,
because
all of that, right.
All of that, because it's America, it's a mystical country,
well,
which
point,
in the 19th
America
century
was
one knew
giant,
very,
the Colossus.
Well, yeah, one knew very little about it, and so on. And here was the strange, drunken poet from Virginia, you know, who had written these wonderful.
Let me ask you something. You think it's possible that maybe in America we make the same mistakes? For example, here
yes,
we are.
Yes, we do.
We take a man like Kafka, about whom I've read that every week he would have his friend, his literary executor, what
Max
was his
Brod.
Name? Max Brod, and his friends would meet and they would roar with laughter over the chapter he'd written. And then we put these things out as huge, holy writ things. Of course, there was more than that.
I think there's more to Kafka's fiction than there is to Poe's poetry. But
the point is, do you think we're making more out of it?
Yes, I think this often happens. I mean,
we make him into a major.
Yes, I'm sure it happens. I think, for example, I mean, Hermann Hesse is a good case in point.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the Hesse
cult. I firmly believe that.
I happen to be rather fond of Hesse.
I've read Steppenwolf, I've read Siddhartha, which I think has elements.
Yes, as a minor writer, he has real charm at times. I think something like
Journey to the East is a one that mystifies.
Oh, that is a terrible book. That's hopeless.
What is that about?
It's junk. But something like Narcissus und Goldmund has some rather nice things in it, and so on.
But in England, you're saying
that. But he's become an enormous figure. Of course, it's the youth movement that has turned him into it. But nevertheless, it's only an American youth movement. No German youth movement would have ever turned him into an absolutely great writer, whereas an American one, which doesn't understand the linguistic problems involved and is not even interested in the linguistic problems. And yet, what is fiction without the linguistic problems?
Well, John, you know, I think what, you know, as I told you originally, we were going to do a program and we'd never have enough time to cover all of the areas we could cover. But I think, to sum it up, I'd like to try to sum it up and see what you think of this. I think what we have tried to arrive, I've tried to arrive at here, and with your help, and most able help, was a definition. It's very seldom can one in the space of an hour define anything. But I think we've defined the function of a critic, and in your terms at any rate, as a man who sets up a standard, and in your case, a rather high standard. You're using art, teaching, and philosophical approaches to your standard. You're setting up a standard and you are then demanding that everything that you criticize that pretends to those standards must meet them.
Right. Absolutely.
And otherwise you are hammering it to death with the absolute limit of your energy.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. And as long as someone pays you for doing that, we've already established you have the right to do it.
Right, and the readers have the right to ignore it.
This is a country dedicated to the idea of, among other things, freedom of speech.
And if they want to read idiotic reviews, there's always Clive Barnes at their disposal.
Exactly. Well, so they can read Clive Barnes, they can Pauline Kael, they can read anybody they choose to read.
Well, Pauline Kael is not idiotic.
We're not discussing idiots. I don't care about that word very much because I don't think Clive's an idiot, and I don't think you really do if you're pinned down.
I really do.
You may think he says certain idiotic things, but
I think as a sort of common, ordinary, garden variety human being, he might not be an idiot, but as a drama critic, he is.
Well, I don't like to end on that note, but I'm afraid we're out of time. And so, John, thank you very much. This is Artie Shaw. The station is WRVR, New York. The program is Conversations with Artie Shaw, and the man with whom I've been having one of the most interesting conversations in this series for me so far is John Simon, noted critic and enfant terrible, if we'd like, in the field of criticism. I guess that's about it, and we'll see you next Tuesday night at 9 p.m.